Attorney General Michael Hollett here.
My sobriety date is June 28th, 2009, and I got sober in Pembroke on a hot summer Sunday. I'm here today to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I can tell you today is far better Sunday than it was a few years ago. Tell you a little bit about my childhood. I come from a long line of addicts and alcoholics, both parents, aunts, uncles. I actually can't really put my finger on one relative that wouldn't be addicted to something of some sort. My sister is an addict. My son is an alcoholic. My mother is a sober alcoholic. My husband is a sober alcoholic. My ex-husband is still an alcoholic. So, you know, it's whether we think it's genetics or if it's something that we just acquire through life, for me, it doesn't really matter. I just know that I really liked alcohol and I liked what it took away from me. And it took away a lot of thoughts, feelings, and emotions. I can't remember when my first drink was, but I can remember my first drunk, and it was, I remember where it took place, but what took place, I'm not sure. I just know that it was a blackout from day one. I was a blackout drinker just about every single time I drank, and it happened whether I drank one drink or if I drank 10 drinks or 12 drinks or two drinks. It didn't matter, I blacked out. I met my first husband, there's a whole lot of family stuff that really doesn't matter. Again, it just, a lot of scarring things happened when I was a child, and just things you see when you're raised in that environment, really nothing that specifically happened to me, just some of the things I witnessed. You know, I saved my family from the house burning because my dad had cooked while he was drinking and passed out. I opened the door to my aunt having attempted suicide. Her wrists were bleeding when I was about seven or eight. I remember that very vividly. You know, so just a lot of bizarre things. You know, you think bizarre things today. Very normal, I guess, in my environment. The one thing I have to say about all of that is I can sit here and talk about it today, but it was never really anything that I thought I held on to. To me, it was just shit that happened, right? I met my first husband when I was 16. We dated for a long time, had our first child when I was 19, got married when we were 23. You know, and all that time we drank, we partied, we had a good time. We were young, right? And I had a really good time with my ex-husband because I was the girlfriend who always let him do whatever he wanted to do because I tagged along and I drank with him. All the other girlfriends, on the other hand, did not really like me because I always tagged along with all the other guys. But it made for a good relationship. I sobered up for a little bit when my kids were born. My son was born when I was 19, and he had a stroke at birth and had to have brain surgery at 13 days old. And as a result, you know, I became a very doting mother. My in-laws, who were not accepting of my pregnancy, became very attentive and really helped out with the young lad when he was born. And so it gave me some free time. And absolutely every single time they took my son, we partied. We drank, we did drugs, we did it all. We had a really good time. Decided a few years later we'd have our second a year after we got married. So we had our second. And again, you know, there's that period of sobriety. You got a new kid and blah, blah, blah. It was all fun and games. And then we were kind of stuck in a place where my husband couldn't get work, and we were feeling a little bit desperate. And so we packed everything up. I moved in with my in-laws, and he joined the Army. A few months later, after basic training was done, we moved to Barrie. Well, and for the first time in my life, I was away from home, had no parental guidance, so to speak. Support was more what it was like. And we were the oldest group, well, I try to say this all the time, we weren't necessarily the oldest, but in the group of friends, we were the only ones who were married and had a place of our own. So a lot of partying went on at our place with all of the new recruits that my husband had gone to recruit school with, and were on trades training. And so there was a lot of partying, and I was justified it. I thought, you know what? My kids finally have a family, and it's the family that we chose, not the family that they got, you know, as a result of just being born into it. And so I justified the partying and all of the socializing and the house full of people in and out all the time, as being okay. We were there for a few months, sorry, a few years, and then posted to Petawawa. And nine, oh shoot, no, 3 months after we were posted here, my husband was posted back to Bourne. So I was here by myself. And that was really the first time I was willing to accept that I had a problem. I always knew I drank differently than everybody else. You know, when I was in my teens, I drank, and I always felt like I was having this surreal experience outside of my body. Like I could see that I was different. You know, I just didn't feel normal. I didn't feel like I fit in. And it was always looking for acceptance. And whether that was because there was that no one around when I was a kid, or if it was just teenage girl stuff, I still can't put my finger on it, because I think just about every teenage girl you talk to will say they didn't fit in, or felt like it anyway. And so he left in Petawawa, lived in a small town, Chalk River. I don't know if anybody is familiar with it. Not much there, 900 people. What else is there to do but play baseball, spend some time with your kids, and drink an awful lot? And so that's what I did. Until one Friday night, when my husband came home and said, you know, this has to stop. I come home every Friday to see you, and you're drunk, and then you spend the whole weekend recovering. You know, ultimatums were then given. And so I decided, okay, I can kick this. So I kicked that habit for a few months. But in the meantime, the parties still kept happening at my place. He kept coming home every weekend. The guys kept showing up. I kept cooking egg sandwiches, and I couldn't handle the drunks anymore. So I started smoking up again. So I did the marijuana maintenance program for a little while, until, of course, I've kicked this habit. I can drink again. So I started drinking again, and managed it okay. 2 years later, my husband went on tour of duty, and when he came home, we separated and divorced for reasons other than alcohol. That was the first time in my adult life that I was on my own and could make decisions what I thought were for myself and in the best interest of my kids. So when I didn't have my kids, I partied and carried on and did the things that, you know, newly single women sometimes do, and every other weekend. Did that for about a year. And I call that my period of self-destruction, because I really did do a lot of self-destruction in that period. I destroyed myself physically and emotionally and morally. I reacted the exact extreme opposite of what I always said I would react if my husband and I had ever separated. And, you know, it really took its toll. Finally, I came to my own little bottom in that resolve, and that I thought, okay, I have to cut this out. So I stopped drinking every weekend, and I started paying more attention to my kids. And I met my second husband in Petawawa as well, and he was military, and he promised me he wouldn't be that military guy that needed to be out playing G.I. Joe all the time. And so everything went well. The other thing was, we had a lot in common. We both liked red wine and lots of it. And so that started that relationship. And we had known each other for about 2 years before we actually started dating. And it was the February after we started dating, which had been about 2 months, and he showed up on Valentine's Day with a beautiful bouquet of roses and a great bottle of red wine. And, you know, and then I had a couple bottles, and, you know, so the night went on, and we had a couple, and we had a couple. And, you know, he had a good job, and I had a good job, and things were great. And so we decided, after having a couple, we'd go out. And so we took a cab into Pembroke, and I'd had some wine, and I was feeling good. And I was, you know, dressed up to go out, and I had no pockets, and I didn't bring my purse. You know, my new guy was buying me drinks. And so we went into the bar, and we had a couple drinks. And he said, and I say that he said because I don't remember. He said that every time he saw me, I had another drink. He said I was talking to people that he didn't know, but clearly I knew. And, you know, we had nice cars, we had a good, you know, we had a nice place to live. And Things like what happened to me just don't happen to people like me. I woke up in jail the next day. And I thought, black and blue, everywhere on my body that you couldn't see that would be covered up by clothes was bruised. I had clearly done something, been somewhere, and it wasn't until I talked to my husband that he told me what happened. And long story short, I was a mess and I created a big scene and almost charged with assaulting an officer. And I guess they just waited not to charge me so that they can assault me back. but either way, that didn't teach me a lesson. If that doesn't demonstrate for me, anyway, the true destruction alcohol can have on someone like me, I don't know what else does, right? And so I continued drinking. I worked at a medical clinic, and a few days later, of course, I'm drinking the nights away because now I'm mortified. And I work at a medical clinic. One of my friends is a doctor, and I don't tell her what's gone on. I'm having troubles with my son. He's drinking, he's driving, he took his dad's car, rode it off in Mattawa. Like he just, 13 years old, really wreaking havoc on himself and us, of course, his parents. And so she gave me these home drug tests. And so I tested myself because I thought, how do you go from having a few drinks to being the way I was? I know how that happens because it was more than a few drinks, but I just felt like there's something not right. So I tested, and of course there was drugs in my system, and I wasn't willingly doing drugs. So somebody had drugged me, roofied me. And I still, after all of that, it just didn't, the light switch didn't come on. And we continued drinking, my husband and I. We had a good life. We moved in together. We eventually got married a couple of years later, moved all the kids together, blending families. Our girls are exactly 2 years apart. So, we're at this stage. We have 8, 10, and 12-year-old girls living with us. Now, I don't know if you've blended families, but blend families with two teenage girls or preteen girls, it's hell. It was absolute torture. I don't know how we survived it. But, to be frank, we almost didn't survive it. It was a very tough time. And as I said earlier, my husband and I had a lot in common. We both liked to drink, and that didn't change. I worked for D&D, and that was also a really good place to work because, there was always a party somewhere. There was always a reason to party. Every spring, you had posting season, so everybody's leaving, so you're celebrating from, May until June. And then every winter from, Remembrance Day until January 1st, you're partying because, of course, it's holidays and winter break and all of that stuff. So it was just a really good environment for people like us. Until it's not, right? And there came a time when it just was not. We were at a, bringing you to my last drunk now, or drink. We were, oh, I'm going to halt there. I'm going to step back. I was working in Petawawa, and I was working at a mental health clinic. And D&D awards nationally 10 scholarships a year. And it's a very lengthy process, and it's a very tough process. I applied 1 year and I was not accepted. And what I applied for was to become an addictions counselor because they were unable to fill these positions for bilingual counselors. And I thought, perfect, I got a lot of experience in that. My whole family's addicted, right? So the first year I applied in 2006, I was not accepted. But the second year I applied, I was. So for a whole year in 2007, I worked from my basement and took the addictions counseling course at McMaster University and became certified in addictions counseling. The whole time, I sat in my basement, had this huge desk, everything set up with a great big giant wine cabinet. And I'm talking giant. Like, it was just, I could just reach and grab a bottle of wine. And we didn't buy bottles of wine. We bought cases of wine. And we didn't buy, a six pack of beer. We bought four or five, two fours at a time. Like it was just free flowing. But the whole time I did this course, I was drunk. It just was. I'd get up in the morning in my pajamas, go to the basement, do a little bit. In the afternoon, I'd start drinking. The whole cycle. By the end of that, they had changed the process of hiring addictions counselors. And so I never actually worked as an addictions counselor because by that time you needed to have a master's degree. It's kind of like that right hand wasn't talking to the left when they handed me over $100,000, right? It was like, we'll pay her salary, we'll pay her education. But in the end, we're still short addictions counselors who can speak French. But I still had a job. So I went back and I worked there for a year. And in the meantime, I had a couple of ladies that worked for me. And one of them just always had this, I don't know, there was just something about her that you just really loved to be around. She was just sweet. And I refer to her as being innocent and serene. And even back then, and I didn't know what it was. So I started there in August, and in February we had to go on training. And she and I were going on training, and I was so excited to get out of the office for a couple of days. And so I said, "All right, I'm going to the liquor store. What are you drinking?" She said, "Oh, no, don't worry about it. Nothing, nothing. I'm good, I'm good." A couple of days later, I said, "Come on, the boss is paying. Let me buy the drinks. What are you going to drink?" "No, nothing, nothing." "All right, sucks to be you." So a couple of days later, we get ready to go. She comes into my office. She said, "There's something I have to tell you." She said, "I don't drink." I said, "Oh, that's cool. I already bought wine. I'm good." She said, "No, I don't drink because I'm an alcoholic." This is the whole boss thing where I have to kick in and be mature, right? Well, you know, how's that going? I didn't know what to say. You know, what do you say to that? I never s knew anybody that got sober. And I had done this addictions counseling course, and I never really knew much about AA because there's like this little wee paragraph in that whole course that you learn about 12-step programs. And which I think today is unbelievable, but regardless. So we go on this course and we go to the first day. You know, the first night we're in rooms down the hall from each other, about four rooms apart. And so the first night I'm in my room with my bottle of wine. It was a Wednesday night. I remember good. I drank my wine. I went to the course the next day. You know, of course, the story goes. I'm hungover, get through the day. The next day we go out for dinner. We go back to our separate rooms and I call her up and say, "Are you going to watch Grey's Anatomy tonight?" She said, "I don't watch that show." And I said, "Oh, sister, are you missing something?" So down the road I go with my bottle of wine. And I sit at the table in her room and I put my feet up and I've got my glass of wine and she's sitting on the bed and we're watching the show and there's her big book. And I picked up her big book and I thought, "What is this?" She said, "Oh, that's the book that we read when I go to these meetings." And she tells me a little wee bit. Just she doesn't really get too deep into it, but she tells me a little bit. So I drank my bottle of wine. We had a sleepover. She slept there. I slept there. We cried over Grey's Anatomy, passed out, got up in the morning. She thanked me for the night. But that was where the seed was planted for me. We continued to work, and this was now 2009. And over that next couple of months, off and on, you know, we'd talk about it, or she'd talk about it, or we became very close. And again, that's kind of where the seed was planted. And in the back of my mind, I never really thought about it again until one night when we were going through that period of posting season. And there I was with my fishbowl-sized glass of red wine again because they were no longer glasses, right? They were like this big, and people like me didn't do the, you know, one-third glass. It was the almost full glass of red wine because I wanted to make sure I got my share. And I was in the middle of the room, and I'm going to say no shit because it was unbelievable what happened to me. I felt it was unbelievable. I was standing in the middle of the room, and there were all these people, and the party's going on, and it was surreal because here I am in the brigade commander's house, which is unbelievable, and I've got my fishbowl glass size of wine, and I had this feeling like I was in a commercial where you see all the cars going by, except for I could hear all the voices, but I was separate from it all. I was on my own in this room and alone. And it was at that moment that I felt something's got to change. My marriage was going downhill. My kids were all doing their own things. I was lonely. I was sad. And I was drunk all the time. I drank every night by myself. And that's all that kept flashing through my mind. And so I went home. Everything was normal. Didn't say anything to my husband. The next morning, I got up and I called Jamie. And I said, "I need to go." And I went to my first AA meeting. A couple of things that happened at that meeting. First of all, I heard a fantastic speaker who made me laugh. Sat in this room and I laughed, sincerely laughed. And at the end of it, we all stood up and held hands. And I still think today, oh my God, they're actually going to hold hands and say, look there. And I inside was saying, oh my God, this can't be happening. Get me out of here. This can't be happening. But it's happening. I'm holding hands and we're saying the Lord's Prayer. And I just feel this huge sense of relief. Like, it's gone. I don't have to do this anymore by myself. That started a roller coaster journey for me. I spent an awful lot of time with one of my best friends, Christine, and I think I say to her often, you remind me of me. In my first 6 months of sobriety, I did the steps. I chaired our AA spring conference. I sponsored. I became GSR. I sat on, I did anything and everything. I just, a month into recovery, I said to my sponsor, I really don't know what you're talking about when I hear these steps talked about. You read them at the beginning, but if they're going to make me feel better, I want to start yesterday. And we started. And, by Christmas, I was done. My life was changing before me. There are a few things she said to me. She said, don't change anything in your first year. I wanted desperately to leave my husband. I was miserable. He was miserable. He'd gone away on course and was coming home on the weekends, and it was just awful. But I didn't know he was struggling with his own decisions and his own experiences. And he was in Toronto on his own, going to school, and was drunk all the time. And he came home in December on Christmas leave, and I said to my sponsor, I can't do it anymore. I'm going to leave him. And he came home, and I had just finished all of my steps, and I had my step work sitting there, and he read my steps. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I had a pretty shady past, and some of it happened while he was in my life, and terribly sad at the thought of him ever seeing that or knowing that, because it tells us in the big book we don't need to harm them to clear up our side of the street. They just need to know what needs to be said. But it changed our life. All of a sudden, when I came home, I knew he had read it because it was sitting there. And I had this huge sense of relief. For the first time in my life, I wasn't afraid of the truth. For the first time in my life, I didn't want to avoid talking about what was going on with me and how I was feeling. But it started a change in our relationship. He admitted that he had been drinking excessively and things had been happening and didn't know what to do. And I said, well, this marriage is over. All of these crazy things happen. And of course, let's give it another try. We went to an AA meeting. He was supporting me, right, this whole 6 months, coming to meetings with me. And but this time here, he heard something, and all of a sudden he started crying, and the rest was history for him. That started his journey. My husband was sober 5 years. In December, on the 18th of December. But I also made a decision in that period that I had to continue doing what I had to do to stay sober for me, that I couldn't drag him along, and that his behaviors of supporting me were not very supportive, and I had to just do it. And either he was going to join me or he was going to stay behind. And for the longest time, I really thought he was just going to stay behind. But there was definitely something that happened to him, and he joined me, and what a journey that's been for us. That's changed our lives. In that period, my mother also saw something happening to us, and she too has 5 years of recovery as of she got sober on the 24th of December that year. When my husband celebrated 1 year of sobriety, my son picked up his first chip. His first white chip. So things in my life were really changing. And it was amazing, that journey. My son still struggles today. He's very young. But I know today, because I've been an example and I continue to be an example, and I leave that door open, that when he is ready, he's got somewhere to go. He knows that he has people who love him and who will support him. Recovery in the last few years has been a little bit different for me. We left Petawawa, and so I left what was comfort for me. And I, not that I didn't think AA was going to be the same, but it was just, for me, it was, I just felt like I was okay. I didn't really need to go to meetings. So for the first year here in Ottawa, I didn't really go to meetings. I went to two or three meetings. And in the last year, I have been trying to get to meetings a little more regularly. I went to a Sunday night meeting and I decided that was going to be my home group, but I went twice. It just doesn't go that way, right? Home group, you're supposed to go to home group. Didn't go to home group. I, you know, you hear often that you just feel that connection. And so I just really didn't feel it. I went and I joined the group because I knew I needed to have a home in AA. And that just didn't happen. So I, you know, I just kept coming to different meetings, and I haven't gone to a whole lot of meetings. But since then, I've decided and joined this group, and so far, really enjoying the company here and the support and the fellowship. Things today are still a bit of a struggle. You know, I started working with another sponsor, and I've not given up my first AA sponsor. She's amazing, and she's become a very good friend to me. But I was really feeling like I needed to get through the steps again. I got to a point where, of course, I was feeling a little dry. I was feeling suicidal, and was starting to see the doctor, and she put me on medication. And I just knew that the solution had to be back here. I needed to be back here. I needed to get back to the basics and work the steps and spend time with more people that are like-minded. Give of myself when I can and when it was wanted and required. Do the things that are suggested in the book. It's fellowship, sponsorship, unity. I just need to do those things so that I can feel whole. And while I'm not involved at the level I was involved with when I was in Pembroke, I had to accept that I don't need to be all. I can just be, and when I'm needed, I'm there and always willing to help. I don't need to have 14 sponsees, and I don't need to be, you know, at every single meeting and at the center of attention, which is not easy for someone like me, because center of attention is a good thing, right? Or at least I think it is. It's actually a dangerous thing for me. I'm just really just being foolish. My new sponsor told me when I said I had a spiritual experience, he said, "Well, what was your spiritual experience?" And I told him about the hole standing in the middle of the room, and he said, "Janet, that wasn't a spiritual experience. That was the moment where your heart was louder than your head. And if you get out of your head and let your heart do the thinking, that everything in your life will be okay today." And so far, it's worked. And when I'm not right, I know it's this that's wrong. It's what I'm thinking. It's what I'm trying to run. It's what I'm trying to change. It's what I'm trying to do instead of just being. And it's not easy to think like that and to live like that when you're still feeling like you need to run the show. It's accepting that I don't need to drive the bus, that going back to the basics is where I need to be. So not letting my head get in the way is really important for me today. I think I'm a miracle, and everyone in this room is a miracle. If you're new or coming back, don't leave before a miracle happens. Thanks for sharing, and thanks for helping me with my sobriety today.
Thank you so much, Janet. That was awesome.
Thank you.